Welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists and opinion makers that bridge our two worlds. My name's Chad O'Carroll and I'll be your host today. The Korea Economic Institute of America recently led Washington, D.C.'s celebration of Korean-American Day by hosting a luncheon event to honor two Korean-Americans for their work in giving back to local, regional, and international communities. Joined at the event by World Bank Group President Jim Yong Kim and NBC4 TV presenter Yun Yang, KEI recognized the work of One Day's Wages founder Eugene Cho and Kyung Yoon, co-founder of the Korean-American Community Foundation. After the event and ceremony, I got the opportunity to speak to both Eugene and Kyung to find out more about their work, how Korean Americans are giving back, and what they thought about being recognized for their endeavors. I started by talking to Eugene Cho of One Day's Wages and asked him to explain some of the background and history of his organization.
My wife and I, we are people of faith. We're Christians, and I think benevolence, kindness, justice, compassion are things that are very integral to our faith, our convictions, our worldview. I would say that, I came to a point in my life where I found myself being more enamored by these ideas and by these thoughts. And it was challenged several years ago when I traveled to Burma. And in traveling to Burma, I saw some things with my eyes that I had only read in books. And it was a wake-up call. It was very jarring in many ways. And one of the things that we saw, amongst many things, was we visited schools in the jungles. And these teachers were just devoting their lives to trying to empower the young children with education. And when later in a conversation I found out that these teacher salaries were $40, and it wasn't per day, it wasn't per week, it wasn't even per month, it was per year. And I was reminded of that quote from Mother Teresa, if you can't feed 100 people, then just feed one. And I think it was that inspiration. We're not going to be able to change the entire world, but we can impact the world of some. And so we were convicted to give up a year's wages. And we say that not to sound boastful in some way, but I've come to learn that our philosophy with leadership is you can't ask people to do something you're not willing to do on your own. And I think that's resonated with people as we invite them to give One Day's Wages, which is the name of our organization.
How hard was it for you and your family to give up 1 year's wages? Because obviously you set the parameter quite high compared to what you're asking others to do.
Yeah, to be honest, I think in hindsight, if I knew how hard it was going to be, if I can be very honest, I don't think it's even a maybe. I wouldn't do it again, if I can be just very honest. When we were inspired by the idea, it took me still a few years to wrap my head around it, because it wasn't like we had $68,000 lying around. It took about 3 years of saving, simplifying. It took a family decision to say we're going to hold off on piano lessons and soccer lessons. I'm so grateful that our kids are not piano prodigies, because that would have been an awkward part of their story. But it was a family decision, but it was a lot more difficult than we had thought, you know. And this is right when the global economy was crashing. And when we made that decision, we thought we could do it. But in going through it, it was much more laborious than we thought. And but again, you know, we're just really grateful, because I think this experience has taught us about the most important things, about our faith, about our marriage, about our children, that we have all that we need, if you will. So it has been hard, but I think it is part of the story that we share.
How do you communicate that to young children, though? Because, I mean, I must imagine for a young kid who is used to getting new toys or the latest gadgets, when dad comes home and says, well, no, let's try things differently.
You know, I'm so grateful that my wife is a family therapist, because we had some really intense conversations, especially with our oldest child, who is now 14, but she was 11. Our kids were respectively 11, 9, and 6 when we made this decision. And it was very difficult for them. And to be honest with you, that the breaking point for us was there was a moment for about 2 months where we needed some extra income to raise the $68,000 that we chose to sublet our home. And we stayed on our friends' couches for a couple months. That was very humbling because it wasn't what we had drafted up in our plans. And our kids were going, why are we packing our stuff? Why are you asking us to pack one toy and a few books and a few clothes? And I think for them, it was very scary because it seemed like we were homeless. We were going bankrupt, if you will. And so there was a lot of hard conversations, but I think it was also very important because part of the reason why we chose to do this amongst many reasons, but one of them was we really wanted to demonstrate to our kids what our values were, what our convictions were, and what better way, even if it's difficult, to be able to model what it is that you're teaching with your words. So our kids are now huge supporters of One Day's Wages themselves. But to be honest, when we started it a few years ago, it was pretty difficult.
What is it about One Day's Wages that is different from other organizations or not-for-profits also actively trying to raise money?
You know, I think at the heart of it, I'm not sure if there's anything truly different, you know, and this is me trying to be as honest with people, to listeners. I think when it's all said and done, we're all trying to do good. We're all trying to make an impact. And I'm grateful that I'm not the first and I'm not the last person to engage issues of poverty and global poverty locally or globally. I pray that there will be many, many more who may be being inspired by this, would choose to be more deeply or actively engaged. But I can say that there are a few things about One Day's Wages, while it might not be exclusively unique, that I do love sharing with people. I love the dignity component. I love communicating to people that we're not trying to dehumanize those who are poor in the ways that we go about raising money. And part of that, I think, is trying to communicate that these are real people with real stories and real children and real parents, and they have real situations. And while they may be poor, they're not, if I can be blunt, idiotic. They're not people that are not able to do things. What we're trying to do is not give them handouts, but what does it mean for us to engage them with dignity, to empower them with resources and opportunities? The other two things that I would speak about is that we donate 100% of donations that come in directly for these projects, minus the credit card fees. So when a person chooses to give their One Day's Wages, and the average American One Day's Wages is about $140 US. So all of that goes to projects that the donor chooses to give to a specific project or to our giving fund, which we use then to give out grants to organizations. The last thing that I would say that somewhat unique is we love empowering everyday people. I don't want philanthropy to be hijacked by the billionaires, rock stars, and celebrities. I love Bill Gates. I like Oprah. I like George Clooney. People say that we look alike. So I like George Clooney. It's just that I want people to realize that we have the capacity to be the root definition of philanthropy, to love humanity. I think this is really important. We need more of this in this world, no matter what people's worldviews may be. And so we give the resources through our website as an open source website where they can donate their birthdays, create crazy idea campaigns that they can make an impact with One Day's Wages.
Now, there are a few things I wanted to pick up there, especially regarding what you said earlier about, I think you said you thought that as we move forward, people might fall in love with the idea of saving the world more than actually doing it themselves. Because I know on social media sites like Facebook, there are a lot of these photos that get shared saying things like, press like here if you want to help this guy in Africa. And it has, you know, like 500,000 likes, and people, I guess, feel good about it. But that's not really doing anything, is it? Clicking something and saying, I like or support this. It's not, there's nothing by itself.
Well, you know, we're living in a fascinating world, and I'm sure that could have been said at any generation. But living in this generation, you and I, we realize how much media and the consumption of media, the distribution of media has changed. The internet has changed the game, has changed the world, and is changing the world right now. So in some ways, it's hard to fault people and our engagement with social media when it is so much part of the way that we engage a community and the world. I think then I don't want to criticize a person that clicks like on that image or that group or that cause. But if we reduce our engagement to just that, we are in some big trouble. And that's my fear, is that I think for some that we see our engagement, that checks the box and we're good. We've done something. I think part of changing the world, there's something painful. We feel good, but there's also something where there's a cost to us as well. And what I often tell people as I travel and speak about issues of engagement and leadership is that I've come to learn that everyone loves the idea of justice and compassion. Everyone. I've not met someone that said, raise my hand, I hate justice and compassion. Everyone loves the idea of justice and compassion until there's a personal cost. And I'm 42 years old now. I'm not a youngling, and I'm still learning as I go, but I've come to learn there's always a cost to justice and compassion, always. And so my hope is to inspire people, not to make people feel guilty, but to inspire them to take steps beyond maybe the easy steps of clicking a like or sharing a retweet or whatever it may be.
And you are affiliated with a number of organizations that your donors give to through your website. Can you give us an idea of what kind of groups these are and how broad is the kind of lens you're looking at?
Well, part of our strength and weakness as an organization is that we're engaged with issues of extreme poverty. Now, part of the strength is there's many, many causes. For those that are familiar with issues of extreme poverty, the World Bank, along with numerous folks, they've defined that there's about 8 categories by which we need to engage issues of global poverty. There's HIV, AIDS medicine, water issues, maternal health issues, education, and on. So we're kind of broad. Our weakness is that it's hard to go deep, if you will. But what we've chosen to do is that we don't want to reinvent the wheel. We could, but we probably wouldn't do a very good job on it because it's hard to be experts in all 8 of these categories. And so part of what we do is that we want to help inform culture, how people see generosity and philanthropy. We want to celebrate the everyday donors. So we go ahead and do a lot of vetting with partners and projects that are on the ground. And some of them are larger organizations, whether it be Charity Water, World Concern, World Vision. But the heart of what we're trying to do is we love partnering with smaller orgs that don't get the kind of media attention or profile that others do. I'm really about the underdog. My personal story is about an underdog story. My parents' immigrant story is an underdog story. One day's wages is your average middle-class Seattle family trying to change the world. And so we love finding and partnering with smaller orgs. And an example of that I can think about is we just partnered with an organization doing work in Iraq called Preemptive Love. And they help train local Iraqi doctors because they eventually realize they have to exit. That's good development. You can't stay there forever. You got to have a vision to get yourselves out of a job. And so they're training local Iraqi doctors. At the same time, they're performing life-saving surgeries on Iraqi children because the rate of heart disease in Iraq is beyond comprehension. And so that would be an example called Preemptive Love. And so we've done partnerships with about 40 organizations around the world.
Do your donors get any feedback loop of how the money is being spent? Do they hear stories or find out about the kind of projects that their assistance is being used on? Or is that more up to the NGOs?
That would be us, yeah. And I'm sure our partners do that as well. We want to collaborate together, you know. We're not just here to raise money. I think there's a lot more that needs to happen than a distribution of a check and raising funds. We want to educate people. We want to help people become wiser donors, more astute donors. We want them to be more engaged, heart, soul, and mind, if you will. We want people to learn about another cause or another organization, and say, I want to get more deeply involved with that. So there's a multifaceted way, but one of our commitments as an organization, even though until recently, we've only had one full-time employee. It was very grassroots. But as I commented on new media and social media a few minutes ago, I will also say it's a very important component to how we function as an organization. It has allowed us to engage donors that maybe 10 years ago with print, we just would not have been able to. This podcast is going to reach people that you and I will never, ever be able to meet. And so using Facebook, Twitter, you know, and videos and so forth, we have a commitment of sharing news of every single grant, to who, for what project, for how much money, for the impact that it's going to make with every single project that we engage in.
I think that's a good point to ask where people can find out more about One Day's Wages.
Yep. There would be three ways. One, obviously, through our website URL, onedayswages.org. We'd love for people to come check it out. And in 5 minutes, they can choose to create their own campaign. For example, to start a birthday campaign is a great way. The two other ways, obviously, one is Facebook. I'm not sure if you've heard of that company. It's a small startup. Facebook.com/onedayswages is a great way for people to get connected with us. And then lastly, we're also active on Twitter, twitter.com, our handle @onedayswages.
Great. Well, I encourage all of our listeners to get involved and start making a difference. Thank you very much for joining us today, Eugene.
All right. Thank you very much.
Following my chat with Eugene, I got the chance to speak to Kyung Yoon. I started by congratulating her on being recognized on Korean American Day and asked her to explain the background of the Korean American Community Foundation.
First of all, it's such a pleasure and an honor to be here. And I'm sorry that a little residual flu is keeping my voice a bit scratchy, but I hope that we'll still be able to understand me. It is such an honor to be recognized in this way by KEI. And, you know, of course, when we started the Korean American Community Foundation 10 years ago, it was something very informal. We never really dreamed that we would be able to be recognized in this kind of national way and internationally. Really came about as a brainstorming session, recognizing that increasingly there are more and more Korean Americans who are actually rising and penetrating, you know, to top tiers of influence in various industries in this country. And yet, there seemed to be an inverse correlation almost, that the more successful you become in mainstream America, the more systematically disconnected you can become from your own community. I experienced that myself, having come to America at the age of 6. And really, you know, growing up with the message that I have to be, in Korean we say 1등, you know, not 1등해라, you must be number one. And in a way, if you think about that philosophy, it's sort of like you're in a race, and the faster you run and you kind of look behind you, and the more distance you put between yourself and the rest of the pack, in a way, the more successful you are. That was the definition. But I think we all recognize that actually, let's turn that definition of success on its head. That it's not about how much distance you create, but how much of the pack can you bring along with you and through that finish line. So KACF really has that vision of taking, organizing Korean Americans who are in a position and have a heart and a capacity to give, and then connecting them with needs in not only the Korean American community, but in broader communities of America.
Great. And so when you got involved, were you one of the kind of founders of the organization, or did you join later on? Like, what was your kind of motivation to start this thing or get involved at a later point?
Yeah, so I was one of the founders of KACF, and purely as a volunteer, and I was a board member. And as I said, the organization just celebrated our 10th anniversary. 4 years ago, I took on a full-time role at the foundation as the first full-time staff, the executive director of KACF. And now we have a full-time staff of 3, which will soon be growing to 5.
And over those 10 years, have you seen any changes in the way people are getting involved with the organization? Is it purely just a fiscal transaction, they give money, or are you seeing more volunteerism?
Yeah, I think what KACF has been a great bridge for many people in our community, many who've been so busy, I think, you know, building their careers or building, you know, their lives, and really have not integrated a habit of giving necessarily into their routines. I think we started with a slogan, $1 a day for our neighbors. And it really was the idea that you don't have to wait until you finally arrive, that you're a millionaire or something, to think about giving back, that you can get into that practice now. So we actually you know, have always said that as much as we would appreciate a major donor coming to us with a $365,000 donation, that it's much more important for KACF that we have 1,000 people who would commit to giving a dollar a day for their neighbors. And that has been the philosophy that has grown and has really taken root in our community.
And do you, your work, is it based mainly in the community or is it a nationwide endeavor?
Well, we started in New York City and we fund nonprofit organizations that are in the tri-state area in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Now, as we have, you know, built up more of a track record and more of a recognition as well, there has been a lot of interest in how do we, you know, duplicate or transfer some of these the kind of work and impact that we have had in the New York area on a more broader and national level.
And what would be some of your goals and your sort of big picture vision? Where would you like the organization to be in 10 years, for example?
I think our goals from the beginning has really been about strengthening the Korean American community. And by that, you know, just as one community is not, you know, is not one-dimensional, we see the potential for greater stratification in Korean Americans as we move forward. You know, a good example, my personal story, you know, coming here at the age of 6, having been absolutely blessed and privileged to be able to have an education in this country, to be able to obviously speak English fluently, and to be given all the tools to be able to navigate American society and corporate culture successfully. But at the same time, we recognize that there are many, many people in the Korean community and actually the larger, you know, Asian American community who are not in the same place and who are very invisible and who don't have a voice. And I think that we wanted to find a way that rather than, you know, saying that there are two Korean American stories, that we find a way to bridge those stories and that the people, again, you know, who have the desire and the capacity to give back, that they can do it through a vehicle that is impactful, that is transparent, accountable, and efficient, and it and resonates for them. I think part of the problem as a 1.5 generation Korean American that I've seen is that a lot of the Korean organizations of my parents' generation didn't have much relevance or resonance for me. You know, their working language is Korean. They're much more kind of, from our viewpoint, maybe not looking so much forward into the American journey, but looking backwards with nostalgia to Korea. Well, I think for our generation and for our children's generation and moving forward, we really need to think about defining and owning what does it mean to be Korean American and really being very inclusive. That doesn't mean you have to speak Korean. Doesn't mean that you have to even, you know, that you can be biracial or that it can be the adoptee population. I think, you know, to be as inclusive as possible and to, in that way, then through numbers and voice and visibility, we can really forge ahead to be a community that has greater visibility and voice in this country.
And I think you're doing well at that because as you revealed on the stage, you were on the front of New York Times just a couple of days ago. Did you ever think, I mean, front page is a big deal. I would have, I'm surprised by it myself. It's, you know, it's quite a feat. How did you react when you saw that?
Well, we knew it was coming because I actually pitched that story to the New York Times.
Right.
So, I mean, the New York Times, as any media outlet, wants to know what's going on. And so they have to hear from people. But again, I think that's a very good example. I'm a former journalist. And I knew that, you know, you don't just wait for, you know, media outlets to come and tell your story. You go in there and you say, hey, this is what's going on. You guys should know about this. And guess what? You know, that was the third most emailed article in the New York Times.
Wow.
At what, you know, for over a 24-hour period. There was a lot of interest in an article that was talking about the rise of Asian American philanthropy and the influence that our community is having and the fact that they showcased KACF as being a great example. You know, in the national conversation today in America, there's so much pigeonholing of immigrants as being the, you know, the ones who come and suck things out of America somehow. And here we have a legitimate story of immigrants who are giving back to make America stronger and who want to contribute in a meaningful way. And I think that is really a story. And the fact that it was on the front page of the New York Times, I'm just so pleased and proud.
Yeah, particularly since negative news is normally what takes stead. Very well done. So what are some of your most notable memories from the past 10 years in working in this field?
Oh, there are so many. I mean, I think the fact that for many of our grantee partners, most of them, we are the first source of institutional funding. They are absolutely off of the radar of the major foundations or even government. And there's just so many hoops that you have to jump through to be able to even write a grant and to be taken seriously. So we see ourselves, I think, our role often, you know, I still remember like the first time that one of our Korean grantee partners came to us for a grant and they wanted to write their grant application in Korean. And we said, no, you have to write it in English. And they were like, you know, you got, how Korean can you really be when you're forcing us to do this? And we said, we're not doing this for our well-being. It's for your well-being, because it's the end game. It's not about just getting funds from us. It's about leveraging, you know-how so that you can go and get funds from all sorts of other, you know, sources that are out there, and yet we as a community have not been able to take advantage of it. And then I think the other really memorable part on the donor side and the kind of cultivation work that we've been doing is our first gala, which was in 2006. And we were scared to death that nobody would come because we were charging $300 a ticket, when in the Korean community, everybody thought of a fundraiser as a $100 ticket and you go eat Korean food in Flushing, Queens. But we were at like a hotel in Manhattan and this black tie, and we $300 a ticket. And we had to make a commitment to the hotel that 250 people would come. It was a minimum guarantee, and we'd be liable for that anyway. And it was just scary to have to sign that contract. But we did. And lo and behold, like, you know, we started promoting the event, and the head of Samsung USA came in as our corporate honoree, and people started buying tickets. And I found myself on the phone with the manager of the Sheraton Hotel saying, what happens if more than 250 people should come? I mean, it's not going to happen, but what happens? And then he said, well, there's a modular wall in the grand ballroom. You can move it to the right, and then you can have up to 500 people. I was like, oh, good. Okay, well, don't do that yet, but that's good to know. Well, a few weeks later, I was on the phone with him saying, I think we've got to move that wall.
Wow.
And then another couple of weeks later, we had to move the left-hand wall. And in the end, our first gala, 750 people attended the black tie event. We raised over $500,000. And I think it was kind of a goosebump moment for the Korean American community and our supporters as we looked around and saw that, wow, there is a lot of potential if we can organize ourselves in the right way. Mm. And now, you know, our galas are routinely attended by more than 1,000 people. And we, you know, last year, we broke our fundraising record well over $1 million. So it's been really exciting to see the culture of giving shifting in our community.
Do you think there's something unique about the Korean American community in being able to pull off these kind of feats? As you know, I'm British and I just simply don't hear about any of this in America. There are lots of Brits here. I know there are lots of other communities that don't have days, and you know, they try and do these kind of events, and it doesn't seem to have quite the draw. But there seems to be something about the Korean American community, from where I'm standing at least, that is a lot more cohesive. And I don't know if you noticed that or.
Yes and no. I mean, I think that there is a cohesion. There is this sort of maybe a national, you know, identity. But the con of that, too, is that you often hear that Korean community does not work well together. That, you know, there's always that saying where they say, you know, you have like three Koreans and then you'll have four churches, you know, because like it starts and then it like, you know, splits up. So I think the challenge for KACF has been that after a decade of work that we are really bringing in more and more people. And that has to do with leadership, I think. And, you know, I know today I was getting so many accolades, but really we need to, you know, establish that a strength of an organization like KACF has been so many people, very, very generous people and leaders, our board members, our staff, our young steering committee, who are all each holding up the organization and really giving of themselves. And I think that has been really important. I think the other side to it too, you know, you being British, I mean, there is definitely something about being an ethnic minority that is, you know, that looks different. And so I think we do, you know, things are so much better than when I was growing up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. as sort of the only Asian kid I remember and feeling very marginalized. But we don't blend in as well after a generation. My children, who are third generation at this point, they're still being asked, where do you come from? And they'll say, like, New York. And then they'll be like, no, but where do you really come from? Mm-hmm. And it's a very innocent question. But underlying it all is this idea, you don't belong here. Where's your country? And their country is here. And I think we all kind of recognize that. And so we need to, maybe that is a catalyst for us to, you know, organize ourselves a little bit more.
It's funny when it's a country of immigrants in the first place that people respond like that.
But I think that it is a country of immigrants, but there is definitely kind of a white privilege here.
Right.
You know, that, and I certainly grew up in this country thinking that, I don't know, like I was playing with my Barbie dolls and I was doing Girl Scouts, but I always felt like this was a country of white people, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was something that I inculcated. But, you know, I think very soon America is going to be at that point where whites will not be the majority. And, you know, it's just, and it makes the country stronger and it makes it I think, you know, the immigrants, the country, being a country of immigrants is such a strength for America.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, now just to round up, where can people who'd like to find out more about your organization, help out, what steps do they need to take? What's the website, the Facebook?
Well, our website is www.kacfny.org. And again, that stands for Korean American Community Foundation, and then ny.org. We look forward to at some point being able to put other city initials after KACF, but we're not quite there yet. But you can certainly find out more about the work that we're doing, our grantee partners, our vision, our philosophy. Also, we have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/KACFNY.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us today on today's Korean Context.
It has been a real pleasure and privilege. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
I do hope you enjoyed today's podcast. You can download other episodes at our podcast website, which you can find at keia.podbean.com. That's keia.podbean.com. We'd also really appreciate if you could leave us some feedback using the comment system on either the Podbean website or directly on our iTunes page. If you'd like to suggest a candidate or topic for a future episode, be sure to drop me an email at ocarroll@keia.org. That's ocarroll@keia.org. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you can join us next time.